In a few moments, we will be conducting our second virtual meeting of the Board of Public Works. As you know, the state of Maryland is still actively responding to the coronavirus pandemic. Governor Hogan has taken a number of bold and decisive actions over the last several weeks to manage this crisis. But nevertheless, we remain in the midst of a public health emergency that will continue to affect our state and nation for many more weeks to come. The response to this new disease requires, of course, that we engage in social distancing in an effort to slow the spread of this virus and protect our vulnerable populations, which is why we are meeting today virtually again. As I stated 2 weeks ago, we know that social distancing and some of the other steps that our administration is taking, including limiting mass gatherings and closing schools and non-essential businesses, has been a challenge for many people and families and has been very disruptive to our everyday lives. These are not actions that the administration takes lightly, but they are absolutely necessary to flatten the curve so as not to overwhelm our health systems, healthcare systems, and to ensure that we have the space and resources necessary to treat those who are ill and those who will become ill with this virus, which is largely unknown, and there is no vaccine or cure readily available at this time. So before going further with the board meeting, I want to provide a few updates with regards to the coronavirus numbers in terms of positive cases in the state. As of this morning, we have 1,985 confirmed cases of coronavirus here in Maryland. Now, understand that less than a month ago, we reported our first three cases of coronavirus, approximately three and a half weeks ago. And unfortunately, we have had 31 Marylanders to die from this virus. And that includes a retired Prince George's County police officer who was a couple of years behind me in high school at Carroll in D.C. And I didn't know him at that time, but got to know him in more recent years because we traveled in similar circles. Some of those circles included one of his better friends or best friends, that's Steve McAdams, who is in charge of our constituent services, as well as his brother, his older brother, went to elementary school with Governor Hogan. And his brother also went to high school with me, a year ahead of me in high school. And so our thoughts and prayers go out to all the friends and families that have been affected by this terrible virus. And we want to assure everyone that Governor Hogan is continuing to focus his entire efforts, and our administration is putting 100% of our efforts into addressing this pandemic. So over the coming weeks, we will continue to take this situation very seriously, and our administration will take whatever steps are necessary to make sure that we keep Marylanders safe. Now, I just want to make two last comments before turning it over to the Treasurer and Comptroller. First, I want to point out that the westbound Bay Bridge lanes are now open a year ahead of schedule, and there will be some interruption at night to make some additional adjustments, but those lanes are open and we're moving forward. Secondly, today is Census Day. Now, while it is also the fact that the census requirements have been moved back a little bit, it's still very important that all Marylanders, all residents of our state, take the time to answer the census. And I believe I mentioned it a couple of weeks ago that if you've received the census card or have gone online, it only takes a few minutes to be able to answer those questions, which is very important to our state in terms of the resources that we can expect to receive from the federal government and decisions that will be made in the coming years with regard to redistricting and a number of other efforts. So take a few minutes, particularly for those who are working from home or at home during this time, to fill out the census. And for some of us who are empty nesters, it only takes a few minutes. This is only two of us that have to report. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Treasurer Cott for any comments.
Thank you, Governor. Yes, we did get the census questionnaire last week and filled it out, and it was remarkably fast and not terribly exciting news to put in, but good to do. And that brings me to say what I don't say too often, and that is my thanks and hats off to Governor Hogan. First of all, I think he's been just a very good, strong leader, what is needed, and prudent, and moderate, and meeting the national governors, was able to achieve practical, important things like postponing or deferring the final date of the census, the real ID, showing America that our system of federalism is so important. We have strong governors, we have good state government, and to at least some extent, I believe, making up for the lack of consistent, good, and reasonable leadership from the White House. And for that, I thank him, and thank you and your administration.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor, and
happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Lieutenant Governor. I would like to just echo what the Treasurer just said. I think almost all Marylanders appreciate the aggressive, rational, honest leadership of Governor Hogan. And Lieutenant Governor Rutherford, if you could give him our personal acknowledgement that he and his team, including you, have been terrific. I would also include Treasurer Cobb, obviously, among state officials that people respond to very favorably. We've all heard from so many Marylanders about the economic and financial situations that have been totally disrupted by the pandemic. Those of us who are lucky enough to be elected officials have the privilege of holding public office. We're going to do everything we can to support Governor Hogan in his effort to save lives. That's our first priority. But that physical well-being and health of our people, as important as it is, we have to protect simultaneously the economic well-being of our state. That's why, as the state's chief fiscal officer, I'm calling on all financial institutions, small and large businesses, and consumers to work together to find solutions that help our families and businesses during these incredibly stressful times. I have indicated that I believe this is time for a 90-day voluntary payment holiday from monthly bills to help families and businesses keep their limited cash in their checking account and their savings accounts so that they can manage the crisis and pay employees, suppliers, or just take care of their own financial security. If we entered into vigorously a form of payment holiday, we could save immediately, as I speak, $6 billion in cash for small businesses, just from mortgages and auto loan, for example, just those two categories, mortgages and auto loans, $6 billion could be saved this month if our citizens went and asked for forbearance from their creditors. We had 42,000 unemployment filings last week. We could have 20% unemployment and 20% reduction in state revenues as we move forward because of the economic consequences of this health crisis. I'm basically urging every individual and every business owner to get on the phone and call every single creditor and say, could I please get a 90-day payment holiday? You'll be stunned at the positive response that you get from the private sector. Obviously, this is not something that can be done by executive order or by even by legislation. We don't control the banks and corporations at the federal level. Many of them are outside of our state's borders. Financial and utility companies have to rise on their own volition to lend a helping hand to their customers who are struggling to stay afloat during this crisis. You know, imagine that you've just lost your job and you're looking at having to pay your normal fixed costs. What I'm encouraging folks to do is call, communicate, connect with. 90% of your calls will be favorably responded to, and I think that will allow you to ride out this crisis. Obviously, there are going to be some creditors or property managers or suppliers or financial institutions that say, go jump in the lake, or you got to be kidding me. Well, we've already done it at the state of Maryland. We now have a tax holiday for 90 days. Nobody should file taxes or needs to file taxes or pay us taxes until July 15th. The private sector, I'm very pleased to report, has told me over and over again, from personal conversations with leading members of the banking association and utilities, et cetera, that they understand what the economic catastrophe is that our families and businesses are going through and how they're hanging by a thread. And they are going to be responsive. They will give you a payment holiday if you ask. They recognize the gravity of the situation. And ironically, the banks are motivated because of federal regulations to allow mortgages, because they get penalized if mortgages and loans go into default. So trust me, 90% of your calls will be answered positively, but you got to make those calls. And I believe if we do over 3 months, we could save a minimum of $18 to $20 billion in people's checking accounts and savings funds. Why do I like that idea so much? It doesn't cost the taxpayers a penny. It involves the goodwill of the private sector, and it empowers individual Marylanders to take some of their financial destiny into their own hands. And gosh knows we have enough free time on our hands because everybody's sitting at home, understandably. So thank you for letting me comment about a payment holiday and the tax holiday that we're going through. And I once again want to end with a strong statement that Governor Hogan makes us proud because of his compelling honesty about what we're facing. And thank you, Madam Treasurer, for making those comments. Governor Rutherford, thank you for standing in for the governor today. And, you know, God bless the great state of Maryland.
Thank you.
And just to follow that, I noticed in the paper today that the governor had issued an executive order deferring the income tax payments until July, like the federal government. And I think that was very good and very helpful. So I'm quite as optimistic, perhaps a little more skeptical than you, Comptroller, but I hope you're right about...
Well, you know, it's interesting, Treasurer Cobb, because someone called me, you know, a big landlord called me yesterday and said, how can you possibly tell my tenants to call me and ask for a payment holiday? I said, what's the problem? He said, well, I have mortgages to pay. I said, well, great, call your creditors and ask for a financial holiday or a payment holiday. He said, well, you know, some of them are out of state, so why would they care? I said, good, send them our names. Maybe we'll recognize some of them. But it turns out that of his 33 loans, massive loans that he owes to these financial institutions, 29 of them are within the state of Maryland. And they're all going to respond favorably. So this is not pie in the sky. I love, what is the organization, Small Business, SBA, Small Business Association? I mean, they're going to be totally overwhelmed. I appreciate the governor putting $75 million from the Rainy Day Fund into relief, but it's a drop in the bucket. And most people are unable to navigate this alphabet soup of government programs. I mean, they're all well-intentioned, but it's just they're out of our ordinary people's reach. So this is something that people are not comfortable with. I know they prefer paying their bills on time, but I'm saying to everybody, whatever cash you have in the bank, keep it there and protect it like a mother lion protects her cubs.
The only thing I would say to that, Comptroller, is that I don't think it should be a blanket, holiday. For those of us, like the three of us here, we're getting a paycheck today. We can pay our bills. So there's a distinction between those individuals and those businesses that are suffering, that have lost their jobs, have been furloughed. My son in California, he's been furloughed. His shop is shut down. He's on unemployment. Those people should be calling their creditors. But the blanket idea, no, I don't think that that's appropriate, because some of us, like myself, my two daughters are telecommuting. They're still getting paychecks. One of them lives along with a couple of other young ladies in a town or a row house in Baltimore that is owned by a couple with a family who just rented that place out because they were able to save up and buy a larger place. So if they stop paying, these people have two mortgages that they have to deal with. And I just think that cascading effect, particularly since they can pay.
I would be the last person to debate you.
The three of us have the ability to pay. So the idea of a blanket is the only thing I have an exception to. But yes, if you have lost your position or your business is suffering substantially because of this, you should call your creditors. You definitely should call and see what they can, how they can help you get through this period of time.
I listen to exactly what you're saying, Governor, Lieutenant Governor Rutherford. I just respectfully disagree. This is a situation where all successful business people are already renegotiating their interest rates and their obligations.
And we're able to pay them. I think that for everyone, I understand for those businesses, for those individuals, yes. But for someone like myself, I can pay my bills, and I paid my mortgage today. And I should not be deferring. My daughters should be paying their rent because they are working. They should be doing that. They should not be seeking any exceptions at this time. We got to keep, some semblance of the economy going. And just to shut it down, even for folks who are fortunate, there are a lot of federal contractors that are essential. Many of them are working at home. Some are still working in labs and still doing business right now, and they can afford to pay their mortgage.
Could I just interject?
As normal.
I strongly disagree with you because we have no idea. Could you just let me respond?
Yes, go ahead.
I'm not suggesting that people in a blanket way call who want to pay and have the money to pay. I'm just suggesting that everybody can call and ask because we have no idea what the next month is going to look like, what the month after that is going to look like, what the month after that is going to look like. If you have disposable income that you would like to allocate, I would suggest buying gift certificates for local businesses in your area. And, cashing them later on down the road. But this is an idea that, unlike the government programs, is immediately available. Nobody is demanding anything. They're just calling and saying, hey, these are really rocky, rough, unpredictable times facing us. Could we please have some renegotiation on our fixed costs? I think it's entirely appropriate.
Disagree. Okay, thank you.
Onward and upward.
Secretary's agenda.
Hi, good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. 26 items on the Secretary's agenda and one report of an emergency procurement. Item 11 is being withdrawn. I'm happy to assist with answering any questions.
Okay.
I would move approval. I don't have any items.
I do have some questions on 5... and actually several, 5, 7 through 10, then we have 13 through 16. A number of the revolving loans with regard to addressing the sewer issues and the consent decree in Baltimore City. My main questions have to do with, do we have any idea if this work has started, and if it has, if it hasn't, when it will start?
Very good, Governor. We have Secretary Grumbles able to join us, along with Assistant Secretary Suzanne Dorsey.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Well, it's an honor to appear before the board. Let me say it's an actual honor to virtually appear before the board. Lieutenant Governor, this funding, $132 million for Baltimore City, Baltimore County. Some of these projects are in the works. They have gone through design. Construction has begun. The Headworks project is critical to reducing back flows and backups into basements and streets. It almost totals $500 million, the investments that state and federal dollars are being put into the city and the county's efforts to reduce sewage overflows. So, yes, some of these projects are already under construction, but it's all part of the plan, and your role in funding it is critical, so thank you. If you have some more specific questions relating to any of these, I or Assistant Secretary Suzanne Dorsey would like the opportunity to answer them.
Yeah, I just was really more concerned about the work being done, and I guess it's through the city's Department of Public Works.
Yeah.
And the county. Okay. Madam President.
Lieutenant Governor, I just wanted to, you brought up something that's really important, and that is the city has contacted us because of the coronavirus chapter that we're in. The unions, the workers, there are safety elements of some of this work. So like any other major project, there are going to be some important precautions taken to protect the safety of the workforce, the Department of Public Works employees, and we are in close communication with them on that front and want to use common sense and make sure that they're not violating any broad rules on protecting themselves. But this is important work that is going to get done sooner than later.
Okay. Very good. Well, thank you very much. Treasurer, you said you had some questions.
No, I was just wondering actually about those items. And I think I do understand them. There is no specific component regarding climate change, Mr. Secretary, but do I assume that this fits within our plans because of the enhanced nutrients?
That is a very safe assumption. I would argue strongly that these investments in wastewater, stormwater infrastructure, and restoring water quality in the Chesapeake Bay, it does fit very well into our climate adaptation and resilience measures. We are seeing that. And as well in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, having more efficient and effective infrastructure systems reduces the energy consumption and energy waste, which also reduces the greenhouse gas emissions.
Good. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Could have turned on your camera during this time so we could have seen your wonderful face.
That's my birthday gift to you, Lieutenant Grumbles. Limited exposure to Grumbles.
Thank you. Like I said earlier, where else would you want to be but doing the Board of Public Works on your birthday? So.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Number 21, and I guess it's 21 through 24, I believe, has to do with the 21st Century School Project, and very happy to see that we're on schedule to have all 28 completed by 2023. all in the works by 2021. I believe all projects are in progress. We have 14 that have been completed, and the others, we have four before us today, the construction documents, and there are another five in planning that should be, construction should start by 2021 with completion of all the new schools and renovations by 2023. So I'm glad that we're on track and that is going very well. One of the things to consider as we move forward, and it goes for higher education as well, and I know the treasurer had mentioned something about that, is that with the coronavirus and the social distancing, I think even once we get past this phase, there's going to be a lot more remote education or tele-education that's going to be going on, and it's going to be something very interesting for not just K-12, but the university settings as well.
All new skills, and the impact, it's going to be very difficult now to predict the impact on funding and financing.
Yes, very much so. You know, are the schools going to need as much dormitory space as they used to have? Right. Is there going to be that kind of difference? And just continuing this side conversation, I recently had an opportunity to do a trade mission, and the president from Morgan and the provost from UMBC attended, and we had an interesting conversation, and this was Corona was still largely an issue in China, and it was starting to spread other places, but really had not impacted the U.S. yet. But we were just talking about the fact that young people are becoming educated much differently than in the past with technology. And Dr. Wilson had mentioned this a survey that was done by an organization he belongs to that 10 years ago, students were saying that they were receiving most of their information in terms of coursework information from their professors. And in a recent survey, 60% were saying they were getting their coursework information from YouTube. And he was saying what is happening. I see you had a visitor. He said what is happening is that students will sit in a class with their professor, a large lecture, but they'll go on their computers or tablets and put their headphones in and listen to a different professor doing the same, covering the same material. So that, you know, if they feel that they relate better to this other professor who could be at the University of Colorado and they're sitting there at College Park, they're listening to the lecture from that professor versus the other. And they were saying it's really going to change how, you know, the education process with this technology. And now you throw in this, it's going to be quite different. But that's it. I don't have any other questions on the Secretary's agenda.
Could I just add one thing on that now that I unmuted myself? that's the concern about equity. As this goes forward, I think it's going to be really important to make sure that it doesn't create essentially a two-tier, two-class system.
Yeah.
And I would move approval of the agenda.
Second.
Well, okay. We're all in favor. I guess Department of Natural Resources. But that's a very good point, Madam Comptroller, and I could go on to say we have an uneven system now, and we don't want to exacerbate it by lack of technology. Madam Secretary.
Hi, good morning, and happy birthday, Governor. Good morning, Madam Treasurer and Mr. Comptroller. For the record, Jeannie Hadaway-Rikido, Secretary of the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, and we have seven items on our real property agenda today for your consideration and approval. Happy to answer any questions you might have.
I didn't have any questions on Department of Natural Resources. Mm-hmm. Well, do we have a motion to approve?
I move approval of the Secretary, who is doing a fabulous job. I move approval of her agenda.
and has a great kitchen, too.
Yes,
please. Thank you.
They're just not anything on it. Give us a panorama. No, I'm just joking. All right.
Definitely heeding the order of work from home.
Okay, well, thank you. The westbound lanes are open on the Bay Bridge now, so it's a little easier.
Very excited about that as well. Thank you.
All right. So I guess we're all in favor on the Department of Natural Resources. Thank you very much, Madam Secretary.
Thank you.
University System Bureau.
Good morning. Joe Evans representing the University System of Maryland. We have 7 items on the agenda. We're here to answer any questions.
Okay. I have a question about 2AE. It's a sole source architectural and engineering over at Salisbury.
On the line, I have Marvin Piles, who's the Vice President of Administration and Finance at Salisbury University, and William Olin, who is the Executive Director of Planning and Constructions at the University of Maryland College Park.
Okay.
Good morning. This is Marvin.
Good morning.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor Olin. Happy birthday, and good morning, Comptroller Francho and Treasurer Cobb.
Morning.
Thank you. And good morning. Yes, this A&E firm was selected under a prior arrangement with a P3 between the foundation and the developer of the P3. But then they were kept after that P3 failed. Maybe failure is not an appropriate term, but it wasn't feasible, I should say. My concern is that the selection was made under a procedure that's a little different than what we would typically do in an A&E contract for a university system campus. And so now we're then just going with them, even though it was a different type of selection process. Can I just hear the justification?
Yes, sir. I would not characterize it as demonstrably different than our process. It began with the Salisbury University Foundation. They purchased the property. They were moving forward with this as a project to support Salisbury's needs. We had 3 old housing facilities that were failing, posed health issues. They went through an RFP process, full RFP process,
and
selecting the...
Excuse me a second. Those 3 that you're talking about, are those, is that Chop Tank and I can't remember the others that are the old...
Yes, sir. It's a Dogwood, St. Martin's, and Chesapeake.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Continue.
So we're looking to take them offline because of the health issues there, mold and other concerns we had. The foundation followed what we would consider a full RFP process, and we supported them in that. They solicited bids. They evaluated those bids, and then they chose a developer. At the time, it was EDR. EDR was eventually bought out by Graystar, and they were with the project. They were instructed by the system to purchase the property for various reasons. That project, the system was not comfortable with the tax-exempt bond funding that they were going to use on the foundation side. So we pursued P3 as a P3 project with Medco. The system also did not feel comfortable with that, so... we're moving forward with revenue bonds to develop the project on the Salisbury side of the house. Graystar has been with the project from the beginning as the developer was, and they had used DCI for the design work.
Okay. I'm
trying to give you as much of the background as possible in a brief amount of time. I don't know if it's...
No, I understand. No, thank you. Thank you very much. But it was the developer that selected the A&E firm, because the RFP, from what I understand based on what you said, was sent out for a developer under a P3, and they selected the A&E firm. And so now that we're doing it as a state project, we're keeping the A&E firm that was selected really in a different method. They weren't selected directly through the procurement authority of the university system. It's just a little different. And so it raises a concern. I'm not going to stand in the way of this. I get concerned when we go outside of our process and then the fact that it's a sole source usually raises questions for the board. I know the comptroller often has questions about sole source contracts. And so I think it's worth bringing the attention of that. Separately, it does bring up points that we were hearing, and the treasurer may remember during our procurement task force, a number of the architectural and engineering firms came in, and when they complained about doing business with the state, they were particularly concerned about doing business with the university system. And their argument had to do with the specifications, the qualifications process that often the university system, they felt, was being a little too stringent. And I think they understood that you should have university experience when you are, designing a lab facility. But when it came to office buildings or housing facilities, there wasn't much different from doing a commercial office or doing an apartment building. And so when I read the item here and you talked about the fact that Design Collective has been doing work for the university before, that's great and good for them. But it also, it reminded me of what the local A&E firms were talking about when they said that specifications go out that require that you have to have done work with a university previously, when sometimes it's just a dormitory or in this case kind of student apartments, that most A&E firms that have done commercial apartments or office buildings could do the same thing. So I just ask that Joe and all of the others that are involved in this, that you really take a look at your specifications where you can offer opportunities to more than just a select few of A&E firms, that you're not just being overly restrictive when it comes to these non-specialized facilities. I understand laboratories are very different, but when you're talking classrooms or office space, liberal arts classrooms, and office space and dormitory or student housing, we need to be more inclusive.
I understand that.
Yes, sir. Let me add in here. I understand and agree with your concerns. I'll just point out that ECI was part of the original bid. They were the winning partner on that. And when that was going out to bid, it was an open proposal, and other companies that we were trying to get companies on the shore to participate. And I can tell you there were some local firms and firms from the Ocean City Rehoboth area that bid on this as a housing project. So it was a true open RFP that allowed other firms to bid on this, not just limited to collegiate housing.
Right now we're at the A&E, and at some point we'll have the construction contract coming through?
Yes, sir.
That is correct, Governor.
Okay. Now, has that been, that has already gone on the street? Slow down, Mr. Comptroller. That has already gone out on the street?
Lieutenant Governor Dowd has not. We have not.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay, thank you. I have a quick question on 3. Did anyone else have a question on 2A?
I have a question on that one.
Okay.
That was two. Just on 2, just to make sure I understand. You went out for a P3, and essentially it wasn't financially feasible, and so we're now using auxiliary bonds in-house, essentially. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am. The system office was not comfortable. We were working with Medco on this project, and in order to move forward with the project, we were going to be rolling our University Park project into this and to make the debt service coverage, but the system was not comfortable with this, and so we moved towards revenue bonds in order to pay for the project.
So my question really is there a way to get a ballpark on how much more expensive a P3 is?
More expensive or less expensive? We did have some numbers modeled on the project. Frankly, with the escalation we're seeing with construction and some other things, we're going to have to be reevaluating the scope of that project at this time to see. The revenue bond approvals have been done through the Board of Regents already. We've not borrowed against that or moved forward with anything with that because of the we haven't put out the RFP for the
right
contractor yet.
Okay. I apologize, my colleagues. I would like to follow up offline and just understand the relative financings.
Are you suggesting we hold this for?
No. I think it's a project that has to go forward. I just like to understand it because I think it may have some lessons for other projects. Somebody's going to have to make money in a P3.
Right. Absolutely. And we're not delaying anything. We're here to do the state's business. I do want to point out, Joe, you got a couple of typos in this item. Maybe they've been corrected since I got this sheet, but we can look at that later. I have a question on 3.
Could I ask a question?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. I listened to the conversation earlier between you and the treasurer about the changing nature of higher education. In fact, it was brought up that people are now going to do a lot more as a result of the situation we're in right now, much more digital education. And you, I think, commented, do we even need new dormitories? And I guess that's my question for Vice President Evans. Have you guys re-examine the need for new dormitory spaces at Salisbury or any of your higher ed institutions based on the fact that apparently we're going to have a somewhat of a sea change as far as how students learn and whether they even need to be on campus? I think the thrust of what some of the earlier conversation might have alluded to.
Mr. Controller, I'm not aware that it's been looked at, but I'm sure that it's something that's going to be looked at in the future. But what I can do is go back to the system and find out exactly has anyone addressed this and find out when they will address are these dorms going to be needed in the future.
Yeah, well, I want to just follow up and say I appreciate the Lieutenant Governor's attention to this. I think it is a bit of an odd thing. And I also share the treasurer's concerns about the somewhat complicated new financing. So I'm open to whatever my colleagues would like to do, but this is an odd proposal.
Could I just say, Mr. Evans, it's my understanding that, in fact, there is a group at the university, at the system level, that's looking exactly at this when they, in the context of enrollment projections and changes in type of enrollment.
But we have some old buildings that really need to be fixed or replaced now. But that reminds me of another question. One of the problems is mold right now, and we have suggested in the past that the university people talk to university people in places like Mississippi and Louisiana, because in a few years Maryland will be like that, and they now have to deal with the questions of mold and similar problems with all their buildings. So will you be able to give us assurance that when the new buildings go up, they will be suitable in the next 50 years for changed climate? How about that?
Joe, if this is Bill,
go ahead.
Would you like me to answer?
Yes, I would.
Thank you. The projects, the housing project, whether it's the ones at College Park or Frostburg or the proposed project at Salisbury, are in essence to replace aging buildings that were built pre-1970s that did not have central air conditioning, did not have dedicated outside air systems, which means bringing fresh air into the rooms. And that has been one of the items that has caused problems throughout the system and other institutions, Madam Treasurer, where just recirculating that air into the building. So all the projects that have gone forward recently include air conditioning systems that bring in filter outside air, help control humidity better than just a recirculating system that would be inside a room.
So is that a yes? Or?
Yes. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. I have a question on 3C, the on-call contracts. And it's just a question. I didn't know offhand whether any of the contractors, engineering and other contractors that are there, if they're small businesses or minority businesses.
Bill, stay on the line. That one is yours.
Lieutenant Governor, I'm going to have to get back to you. This is different than our, we just did a renewal recently on our SBR MEP on call. So I don't believe one or two of these, I'd have to actually check with our procurement folks. Now, what I could say is traditionally we've included other consultants as part of the team, and those consultants are MBEs and sometimes both MBE and SBRs.
Okay. Yeah, if you can get that information with regard to the primes, that would be helpful. And just making sure that the small and the minority businesses at least know of these procurements so that they can compete. And I think you do a good job generally with regard to getting that information out. But just to know that they can compete for this and not just wait for the small business on-call contract vehicle. So I just want to, if you can get that information to me, I appreciate it very much.
Will do, sir. And as you have addressed in prior meetings to Joe and I, we've looked at increasing the dollar threshold or task order limit on the SDRs to give them the ability to potentially do larger work, as you've asked and suggested. So we've taken that under advisement and proceeding.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I don't have any additional questions. I will say that I know that we pulled off a couple of items from last week's agenda. I still have some questions with regard to those, so we'll be working with your folks, Joe, to make sure we get those questions answered before bringing it back.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions on the university agenda?
Move approval.
Second.
Okay, we're all in favor. Thank you, University
thank you.
System. Joe, thank you.
Thank you, Board.
Okay. Department of Transportation.
Good morning. Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, my name is Greg Slater, Secretary of Maryland Department of Transportation. Maryland Department of Transportation presents 12 items today. Myself and some representatives are here if you have any questions.
Well, thank you for getting that the westbound area of the bridge open a year ahead of schedule. There was a lot of concern when it was first being done, but it was necessary work. I know it was disruptive, but it needed to be done or people could possibly fall into the bay. But, you know, getting it done a year in advance was yeoman's work, and thank you, and thank your team, thank contractors, everyone who's been involved.
Absolutely. Thank you. Really, I credit the whole team for coming together and just rethinking how we do this. The contractor, the MDTA team, Executive Director Jim Forts, and our Chief Engineer Will Pines, they really came together and rose to the challenge.
Very good.
Could I just say something? If I could, I want to reinforce what the Lieutenant Governor just said. And I want to thank all the local elected officials on the shore that raised a big hullabaloo about this. The initial response from your predecessor was just, you're just going to have to lump it. Sorry, it's going to be a two-year project. And all of a sudden, he was no longer with us, and you were appointed Secretary Slater. And I want to thank you for completely redesigning and remobilizing the project. And it's really, if I had been told back then when we were complaining about this and being told to just, you know, you're just going to have to get used to it for 2 years, that you were going to be able to announce today, April 1st, that a lot of the work had been completed, not all of it. There's still going to be some inconveniences. I would have just said you're crazy or that it's an April Fool's joke. In fact, it's reality. So thank you on behalf of the great state of Maryland. I compared you to John Porcari, one of the legendary transportation secretaries in the past, and I completely support that comparison. Thank you very much for what you accomplished.
Well, you're very kind, and I will credit the whole team for really coming together and working hard on this. Warm weather helped us a little bit. Light traffic helped us a little bit. But I credit the whole team for coming together on this.
I will, though, defend Secretary Ron for a moment. You know, a lot of the success that we're seeing today was put in place by him. He didn't want to promise, you know, that we would be able to get everything done so soon. No one wanted to make that a public promise, but we felt that with the efforts that Secretary Ron was putting in place, that we might be able to get to this point. And the Secretary Spider, has picked up that ball and has been able to move, like you said, along with Director Ports and his efforts as well, and then the grace of having warmer weather, or maybe the curse, Madam Treasurer, but we were able to get this done. But, you know, maybe Secretary Ron didn't deliver his message in a way that was reassuring, but the plans were put in place when he was here, and he left because his wife threatened him that he needed to come back to New Mexico or stay here forever. And so it had nothing to do with his performance. So thank you.
Absolutely, brother, for really carrying around and putting a lot of measures in place. And certainly the team came together really behind the scenes and took advantage of every opportunity.
Okay. You're breaking up a little bit. Are there any questions on the transportation agenda?
Move approval, if not.
I do want to, I'm not going to, these aren't questions. I just want to point out the good work that transportation is doing at aviation, at MDTA, at MTA by utilizing the Small Business Reserve Program. Aviation is utilizing both the Small Business Reserve Program and certified minority businesses as prime contractors. And so you all are definitely a model agency for the rest of the state agencies with regard to utilizing small businesses and minority businesses, and so motor vehicles as well. I want to point that out. So thank you, and thank all of your team and all the Molders with regard to the work that they're doing.
Governor, could I?
Yes.
Could I suggest it might be useful for all of the agencies, and certainly for us who are sitting here learning week by week, how MDOT, with its own system, has been able to move ahead with MBEs and subs, but also bringing in primes, because it seems to me that some agencies have more difficulty doing that. And I think it would be worthwhile for us to all hear at the same time how it can be done.
Sure. We put a significant amount of effort into mentoring MBE firms, mentoring DBE firms, mentoring our small business firms.
I didn't mean this very moment.
Oh, okay, sure. Certainly I can put the material together for you.
I think it really would be very helpful, because this question of primes has been an ongoing one, and how you count, how they count.
I will highlight that in this challenging time right now, we're actually holding a virtual town hall for our MBE DBE community to learn, and our small businesses to learn how they can take advantage of the program out there.
That's terrific. We should learn more, and then people have to make decisions, and other agencies should learn more too.
Well, as he said, and as you know, the university, Joe was talking about what they're doing at the university, is that it does start with the leadership, you know, sending down the message to their program managers and procurement officials that you need to look for these, you know, opportunities to work with small businesses. And sometimes it means changing, unbundling a large contract, taking pieces of it out, changing a mindset, and that's what Joe was talking about previously, in terms of how much work, in terms of volume, that a small business can do. And so sometimes it takes a little more research on the part of our procurement personnel. And transportation has done a very good job, and I think as we continue to further professionalize our procurement staff, which includes compensation and training, that they will be able to perform just as well. Thank you.
Great message.
Okay. And we do have a motion on the table for the transportation agenda. Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay. I think we're all in favor. Thank you, Secretary Slater. General Services.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Comptroller. For the record, I'm Nelson Reichert, the Deputy Secretary of the Department of General Services. If I can stick the word in from the Department of General Services, happy birthday, Lieutenant Governor.
Thank you.
Today we are presenting 23 items, including two supplementals, for your consideration. Provisions have been made, have been submitted for items 1 CGL, 6 CGL, 7S, 8S, 13G, 14T mod, 16IT, 20LL, and 23IT. We do have representatives available to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, a quick question on 8S. And Nelson, do you have a cell phone on that's near you or near the speaker? Something that's seen when you popped on and started getting feedback.
I don't believe there's anything else in here that would.
Okay. All right. Okay. On 8S, this is just a quick question on the contract. I guess it's going to go to C.P. Richard Elvis. Does that include the title services?
I have Wendy Napier here, our Assistant Secretary for Real Estate, to answer that if you would.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I can confirm the broker services contract does not include title services. Our title services RFP is actually closing today, and we typically bring that to the board in June of each year.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. I'm going to jump to item 15, IT, unless Director Comptroller have questions in before that.
I had one about the hospital.
So
we support strongly. No question. We need the hospital, and
yes.
To see progress being made. But the Lieutenant Governor brought up the question of MVEs. And this raised in my mind and in the mind of some legislators question of how we work MVE goals into these sorts of what are essentially grant programs. And I just want to put sort of a stake in the ground saying, I think we should come back and look at this. I'd like to understand better the process and how, I mean, this is a $56 million, this is a large grant.
Right.
How these issues are worked into different types of programs like this.
All right. Shirley Kennedy's here.
That's a very good point. Because, this, particularly like this one going to the university system, University of Maryland Medical System, we're doing, I know there's an emergency contract that the University of Maryland Medical is doing with regard to Laurel Hospital, getting that up and operational. And so there are concerns about, both emergency contracts, but just where we're providing the funding in this case, like the treasurer said, a $56.2 million project to making sure that there is MBE participation.
And I believe that there is. The university and the departments and everyone has the right goals in mind, the end in mind, but to understand how, when it's not a typical procurement, those ends are gained, I think is really important. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Good morning. I'm Shirley Terrell, or Shirley Kennedy. And I'd like to say good morning. I am the director of the Capital Grants Program. And with respect to your questions about the capital grantees, because the individual grantees, like UMMM, conduct their own procurements, We are not involved in the procurement at all as far as MBRs are concerned and setting goals. But what we do is to encourage them to use the process and encourage them to also use our MBEs and SBRs and provide for them a listing of contractors that can work on these large capital grant projects.
But and then are the reports, do you then find out what has been done?
What we do as they actually submit their contracts for review by our office, we do a checklist to determine whether or not MBEs and the SBRs are involved, and so we have that for each of the contracts that the grantees have awarded. So we do have the data, but there are no goals that are set, but we do have the data for all of the contractors.
All right. Well, I just wanted to put the issue on the table. I think we could all learn, I at least could learn more about it and to understand and see if there's a way we can assure everybody that the state's goals are being met, even though I understand this is a grant program and it's different than a typical procurement. And I agree with the lieutenant and the governor and comptroller shared this concern.
Yeah, and this is something we can explore, and we can talk to General Service about this in terms of, couldn't we put into the grant agreement, you know, some goals or utilize best efforts or something of that nature, so we can look into that. I would think if you're accepting the money, you know, there's always strings attached. So at least
for well, and we have no reason to think they don't want to do what they can.
Right. Okay.
We will look into it.
This is item two.
Yes.
No, I strongly support it. And yesterday, apparently, the President of the United States announced that we, in a best-case scenario, are looking at 100,000 to 240,000 deaths from the coronavirus. That's under the best of circumstances. And I believe he also mentioned it could go as high as 2.2 million Americans who died from this horrible virus. So I just want to thank the first responders and the healthcare workers who apparently have all sorts of concerns about equipment, et cetera, being made available. But I want to applaud them for their courage. Many of them are walking into obviously suffering from this horrible virus in order to save their patients, and means a lot to me. I think they're true heroes.
And we can't afford to lose them.
Right, right. They're definitely heroes every day, and not just in this situation. 15 IT.
Yes, Linda LeMoon and Nikki Charleston are available.
Okay. It's more regarding, my questions have to do more to do with the special election that is going to take place at the end of this month, and then the primary election that has been pushed to June. I know that there's been discussions. Well, first of all, for the special election, it's going to be done via mail for the 7th district, and but there's still questions in terms of how do you handle those with disabilities who may have difficulties with regard to a mail-in special election, as well as the primary. I understand your board has voted to go all mail for the primary also, but I'm not sure it addresses all the issues associated with those who may have disabilities.
Good morning, Governor. It's Linda LeMoon with the State Board of Elections, and with me on another line is Nikki Charleston, my deputy. As everyone has said, I wish you a happy birthday.
Thank you, Rick.
And I would like, if I could, express publicly my immense gratitude to not only my staff, but the staff at all the local boards who have been working to prepare for the upcoming elections and just putting in yeoman time and work. The Board of Elections at its meeting last Thursday discussed the issue about how to best accommodate folks that needed assistance. And they noted that we have an online ballot delivery system with an accessible ballot marking tool. And the tool has been tested by the National Federation of the Blind and the University of Maryland, University of Baltimore Usability Testing Lab. And we've used it successfully since 2012. And the system is also designed to work with the voters' own accessibility features and tools on their home computers. So there's nothing new for them to learn in order to use it. And the board felt that under the circumstances with the virus at the time and now even more dire situation, that we needed to minimize any person-to-person contact. So they felt that the tool was available and should help mitigate the issue.
Has that satisfied the those advocates, and I don't know what the Assistant Attorney General has said with regard to any of this, does that satisfy the advocates who've been concerned about a mail-only ballot?
Well, Governor, I have not heard from them, so I can't answer your question.
Okay. All right. Well, there seem to be some concerns out there. I noticed that one of the senators, Senator Kagan, had some concerns about just the idea of the confidentiality associated with the ballot being something that's private and how we address that as well. But it sounds like you're working on it. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I would just like to add that part of the problem with having person-to-person voting is the availability, or now the non-availability of public transportation, especially in the urban areas, because you all don't want, and I wouldn't want my folks either to be riding around on buses and so forth. So I think we all need to keep that in mind as we keep designing what we're doing.
Well, yeah, I think even probably more so is the getting the workers to the locations, because often they are retirees who might be a little older or might be in the high-risk categories that get there. With regard to the April special election, what type of activities have you put on so far, particularly as it relates to reaching the communities in the 7th Congressional District to make sure that they know, first of all, that it's going to be mail-in, that they're not going to their polling places. And then even with that, have you mailed out ballots, given that we're 3 weeks away at this point from the election?
Right. I'd like, if you don't mind, Governor, I'd like to ask Nikki if she could please lay out some of the outreach that we've been doing and we plan to do.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. This is Nikki Charleston, Deputy Administrator. Thank you, Linda, for the opportunity to talk about the voter outreach efforts and the schedule for mailing ballots. I'm pleased to report that the first batch of ballots will go in the mail today, with continuing through Friday. So by Friday, all of the voters in the 7th Congressional District will have ballots en route. We are working with, we have a contract for some PR support and are looking to expand that to provide a much greater voter education about the change of the way we're delivering the election and the important deadlines that are coming up. Our first focus, of course, will be on the 7th Congressional District and making sure that we are targeting voters in that district. And then we will, depending on the board's action tomorrow, at tomorrow's meeting, we will then start focusing very quickly on any changes to the June 2nd presidential primary election.
Okay. Now, with regard to the PR support, I'll get to the ballot mailing in a moment, but the PR support, are you utilizing entities that can reach into the urban community? I'm not sure who, it's not important who you're using, but, sometimes utilizing large PR entities don't necessarily always speak the language or able to reach the communities that may not necessarily follow on, the typical ways that we reach people. Have you looked at how you're going to reach primarily an urban community?
So we're fortunate in that our PR team includes people that are familiar with Maryland and have access to those advocacy groups. We've also, through the Assistant Attorney General, have been talking with the advocacy groups to see about how they might also help us spread the message to their constituencies. So at this point, we're going to welcome any and all help that we can get, getting to as many voters in the Congressional District 7 first, and then statewide for June if that's necessary.
Okay. Well, sometimes groups who are familiar with Maryland doesn't mean that they're familiar with, what happens at the grassroots level. And despite what sometimes they'll tell you, doesn't mean that they, are right there. Now, with regard to the mailing of the ballots, you're mailing out today, but I think many of us and all of us sitting on the board today have been in campaigns and know that sometimes when you mail out to people, their addresses change, things are different. So mailing at this point, and particularly mailing ballots, to me seems as though you're going to get a lot of those coming back, where people have changed addresses in the last year or so and have not, you know, notified the local boards of election. Just in my mind, as kind of a layperson, I would have thought that once the decision was made to go to a mail ballot for the April special election, that if nothing else, a postcard maybe should have gone out, and then that outreach effort to say, if you have not received a postcard, check with your local board of elections with regard to, you know, whether your address is correct. So, because you will be receiving a mail ballot in the coming weeks. So I think at this point, mailing out ballots, I mean, you have to do it, but I don't think you're going to, I think you're going to miss a lot of people who may have moved, you know, A, B, someplace else in the hospital or whatever the case it may be. But I would have hoped that you have gotten this a little sooner than now. How are you going to address it? The question is, how are you going to address those that come back, those ballots?
Sure. So a couple of things. So we have one of our primary sources of information is the MVA, and understanding that they are closed for in-person transactions, we are still receiving hundreds of electronic transactions from them a day. And over the last year, we've been receiving thousands of transactions, with many of which are changes of address. As soon as the governor's proclamation was issued on March 17th, we did start pushing out messaging about make sure your address is up to date and how to do that. So we started on that immediately after the governor's proclamation on March 17th was issued. We need to get the ballots out, and that's what's happening. Giving us 4 weeks, getting them out 4 weeks before the election gives us time to receive them back and try to find the voter, as well as we're getting calls from voters and requests to change addresses as they've been hearing about this change and understand, oh, I'm at college, but now I'm home. I need to change that. And so people seem to be aware. There's always more people we can reach, and we are working to do that, and we'll continue to do that all the way through the April 28th election.
Okay. Very good. At least, okay. So when you do receive them back, any that come back, you'll try to go back and see if there's a way to reach them. And the locals, because you have three boards of elections that are going to be addressing this as well. So I guess they're looking at their portion of the district.
Correct. Those ballots will be returned to the local board of elections directly. And to the extent that the post office provides a new address, we will be, you know, using that address and continuing to reach out to voters, both receiving the request as well as being proactive to reach out to them.
Okay. All right. Thank you. My last question, candidates who want to get on to the November ballot that are not affiliated with the major parties, they typically have to get signatures. Is there any consideration of allowing for e-signatures to get on the ballots?
We have started looking at that question already and working with the Attorney General's office to see how we can best accommodate not only the candidates, but potential new parties and any referendum. So we're still trying to figure that out.
Okay. Because what is it, August, there's an August timeline for collecting a certain amount of ballot or signatures right
now? I think it depends on the type of signature gathering. I think for candidates, yes, that sounds about right to me. I don't know about the process, for example, for a petition to amend a charter, county charter.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Is that in statute or regulation? Do you know? Offhand, I haven't looked.
It's in the Constitution and in the statute, and we have some regulations, and then, of course, for the charter amendments, there might be some charter provisions.
Constitution probably did not envision e-signatures.
No, probably not.
You must get a signature I have to pull out, I have a pocket constitution here, state as well as the U.S. I have to look at it. It probably says signature. It probably doesn't say by hand. But okay.
The state is authorized, and the governor has further expanded that, the use of digital signatures for various transactions. So we're working with the Attorney General's office to see if how we can accommodate the process.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Could I ask about the April election? Do you have any projections on participation, turnout?
No, we don't. I mean, with everything that's going on with the virus, it's all over the place. I think in this other states who had their primaries, of course, if they weren't as far advanced with the intention as we are, it's been a pretty good turnout, but I don't know whether or not the virus is going to tamp it down.
Yeah. Okay.
Could I ask a question?
Sure.
Sure, Mr. Poole.
So, forgive me for being blunt, but I am highly skeptical about this ability of the state to pull off a mail order election or mail ballot only election. A little less concerned about the congressional race because that probably will have a lot lower turnout, but the statewide race June 2nd, I think we're still waiting to get the results from California of their statewide election. I don't remember that ever getting reported. So I guess I'd like to have Administrator Lamone walk us through again the state board's plans to make sure we have a seamless and secure election since nobody's going to be voting in person. And most, let me just finish, most importantly, an accurate and timely counting of the votes to prevent delays in announcing the election results, such as we had in California.
Well, first of all, California wasn't a statewide vote-by-mail election. Some of the issues were raised because they introduced some new voting systems. But the other point I want to make is there is no plan in place yet. The state board is meeting tomorrow to finalize whatever recommendation they're going to provide to the governor, and then it's up to the governor to decide how he wants us to run the election. And that depends a lot on the Department of Health's predictions. In my opinion, it depends a lot on the Department of Health's position on, sorry for the phone, where we are in the infection rate and whether or not there can be person-to-person interaction. So there's some factors out there that are completely beyond my control.
But yeah, and forgive my lack of confidence in us doing something that we have never done before in the state of Maryland. But I do have some real questions based on hopefully there aren't any apps involved in this like there were in Iowa.
No, Iowa is a caucus, not an election run by the party. We don't use apps.
In getting election results?
No, we don't. We have a certified network that we use.
And Mr. Comptroller, I echo your concerns. And I thought my understanding of California was a statewide, and they were doing mailing, but they also were opening selective sites that not, you know, the full menu of sites that we typically have for, you know, in-person voting. But they were trying to go, and Los Angeles County in particular was a basket case because they didn't get out their ballots. They didn't get out enough ballots. And then people were not as aware of those sites that they needed to go to, and they had long lines. So, yeah, I mean, they had a real challenge out there. Right now, it's only going to be the 7th District. But, you know, I know last election cycle here, we had some challenges. And Mr. Comptroller, I guess you had some questions. I guess those questions were answered with regard to what happened and how certain polling places didn't have ballots, or they ran out of ballots in the 18 election. But I think those were answered, if I'm not mistaken. I never heard that answer, but maybe the governor and yourself did.
It's a difficult, changing environment, Lieutenant Governor. I don't mean to, and I certainly don't take any pleasure in how difficult it is, but since we are launching into a brand new program, I do have some major concerns about whether we can pull it off with the confidence of the voters as a result. I always hope for the best and prepare for the worst, but I think some of your, we never did really find out, other than just sheer incompetence, why there were not an adequate number of ballots.
Okay. So, yeah, I think seeing what takes place in April with just one congressional district is going to tell us a lot of what can be done in June when we're going statewide. So we're going to have to really, you know, pay attention to that and see how that's going to come about. I do still have one more question. It's a task order within 16IT, and it has to do with the State Board of Elections. This is a data center operations task order, with a data center operations company that is based in Chantilly. Where is actually the data housed? Is it housed in a separate data center that's in Chantilly, or is it here being in the state?
Hi, Governor, it's Linda Lamone again. The primary data center is in Columbia, the location.
Columbia,
we do have an office. Yes.
Okay. There, just make sure we're in Columbia, South Carolina, or, you know, there are other Columbias around. So, Missouri.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Columbia.
Our Columbia.
Our Columbia. Okay.
Yes.
Not Columbia, South
no.
Carolina.
No.
Okay.
No.
All right. Okay, that was, any other questions then on the Board of Elections or General Services generally?
Move approval if not.
I don't have any more questions.
Second.
Okay, all in favor? Thank you. We've had another, as far as I know, another successful virtual Board of Public Works. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Been a pleasure.
Thank you.